This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. One of my favorite things lately has been watching Schmigadoon, the series that is both a tribute to and a satire of musicals of the 1940s and early 50s, like Oklahoma, Carousel, The Sound of Music, The Music Man, and of course, Brigadoon. My guest, Cinco Paul, wrote all the songs. He also co-created and co-wrote the series. Along with his writing partner, Ken Dario, he wrote the animated films Despicable Me, The Secret Life of Pets, and their Dr. Seuss adaptations, Horton Hears a Who and The Lorax. Schmigadoon is streaming on Apple TV+. It stars Cecily Strong and Keegan-Michael Key as a couple who try to repair their relationship by taking a hike in the woods. They get lost in the woods, cross over a bridge, and suddenly they're in a small town called Schmigadoon that looks like a stage or movie set from the early 20th century. The women are wearing prairie dresses with long petticoats. Their men are dressed like they're in a barbershop quartet. It turns out, in this town, life is a musical. And it's a musical set at the turn of the century. People sing their feelings, and dance, too. This is initially charming for the Cecily Strong character, but Keegan-Michael Key's character hates musicals. Soon, they realize they're trapped in this musical, and like it or not, their conversations will be interrupted by townspeople breaking out into song. In this scene, the couple has just entered Schmigadoon, and they are totally disoriented. Then, the townspeople break out into song. See if you can recognize what inspired this song. Cinco Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for creating this series.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How did you come up with the idea of a musical about people trapped in a musical set in the early 20th century?
Well, it's kind of crazy. I had the idea for this almost 25 years ago. And it was while I was watching the movie An American Werewolf in London, of all things, one of my favorite movies. And it opens with, you know, two friends hiking through the wilderness, and they're hiking over the countryside. And I suddenly thought, wow, the opening to this is very much like the opening to Brigadoon. And then I thought, what if these two modern guys, instead of stumbling on a town that has a werewolf, stumbled on a town that was in a musical? And that was the germ of the idea, but I didn't really know what to do with it. So it was one of those that I just filed away. But what really cracked it for me was, oh, instead of two friends, it should be a couple. So that it is more of a romantic comedy, and it can be more about what does love mean? What's true love really mean? I think that's why for 25 years, nothing happened with it, because it needed that addition to really crack it.
So the Cecily Strong character loves musicals. The Keegan-Michael Key character hates musicals. Why did you want him to hate musicals?
Well, I thought it was really important. I mean, first of all, it's really funny to have someone who hates musicals be stuck in a musical, but also for him to be the eyes and ears of the people, unlike me, who don't love musicals. And in many ways, that was Ken. And in many ways, it's my wife, you know, that...
Oh, boy, you're trapped.
I'll tell you, Ken and I, you know, played music all the time when we were writing. And whenever a musical theater song would somehow pop up in my mix, he would say, skip. He was not a fan. He's become a little more of a fan. And, you know, I wouldn't say my wife hates musicals, but she does not, you know, embrace them in the way that I do. So it was really important for the show to have that perspective.
One of the things in some musicals is the love affairs in some musicals, I think, would be considered pretty age inappropriate now. Like, for example, The Sound of Music, where, like, she's a young nun who's just left the convent, and she ends up, you know, falling in love with this kind of mean-spirited older man who, of course, becomes a much better human being as soon as he falls in love with her, this kind of, like, magical transformation. And South Pacific, there's a younger woman who ends up falling in love with an older man. I think you have a shout-out to that.
Yes.
And so is that one of the things you wanted to play with? And also the idea that, like, love can totally transform a person into, you know, a kind of stern, rigid person into a much more loving, lovely person.
You know, when we were in early on conceiving of the show and the journeys that our characters would take, I really wanted Cecily's character, Melissa, to be involved in what I think are the two big tropes in these old musicals. One is the bad boy, you know, which is the Billy Bigelow character. And then one is this the older sort of father figure love interest, you know, that you see in King and I and Sound of Music and South Pacific. Like, clearly it was a thing for Rodgers and Hammerstein. And there is something weird about these old men, you know, sort of creating works of art in which there are these May-December romances. And so we played with that in two ways. Also, Keegan has this young farm girl pursuing him, played by Dove Cameron, and immediately he's concerned about the age difference, especially because the actresses, you know, who play these roles were never actually teenagers. And so we play with that trope as well.
Some musicals have really corny scenes in them. And the kind of scene that always bores me is the picnic scene, where it's like, this was a real nice clam bake. I'm really glad we came. It's like, can we skip that? Can we skip that and get to the good stuff? And, you know, even like operas have songs like that where there's, you know, like a festival or, you know, a picnic or something. And like, those are usually boring too. And I never really understand the function that they serve. And you kind of have a song parodying that called Corn Puddin'.
Yes.
And so the reason why they're singing about corn pudding is it's their first morning in town, and they're sitting on the porch and about to have breakfast, and they're asked if they want some corn pudding, and they don't even know what corn pudding is. And then the town just starts singing about how great corn pudding is. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you think of those moments in musicals where you have to sing about food or a picnic or a clam bake.
Yeah, I mean, corn pudding came out of, initially was thinking, you know, what is the song that is most going to annoy Keegan's character? What would be the worst possible song to subject him to, you know? And it's just, oh, a song just about food. And corn pudding suddenly came to me as just, it's kind of the perfect representation of these sort of songs, like the It's a Real Nice Clam Bake. Like, who cares? Like, you know, the songs really should move the story forward in some way. And I think the worst example is Shapoopy from Music Man, which is, it brings everything to a grinding halt. And then this Marcellus character is just singing this nonsense song that has nothing to do with anything. And so that's what Corn Puddin' is. It's an ode to those songs. But the fun thing is that, ironically, in our show, it does move the story forward, because this stupid song gets Keegan to say, okay, we're leaving. We're not going to spend another minute in this town.
And the waitress delivering the corn pudding is the younger woman who's pursuing him.
Yes.
Why don't we hear Corn Puddin', and we'll also hear the Cecily Strong character kind of join in a verse, much to the Keegan Michael Key character's annoyance.
You put the corn in the pudding. corn pudding?
We want corn pudding.
Who wants corn pudding?
We want corn pudding.
I think they want us to take a break.
I'm not singing and you're not singing.
Come on, could be fun.
No, do not.
Never had corn pudding.
Why?
And it may be a waste, but if you've got some extra.
Extra?
I sure would like a taste.
Oh, she sure would like a taste. Corn, 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 corn. Yum!
Yum! That was so weird. It was like as soon as I started singing, I knew what to say.
That's fantastic. Can we please go now?
What? Why?
Are you serious? The entire town and you just spent the last 5 minutes singing about corn pudding.
Did somebody say corn pudding? Corn.
That's it. We're leaving.
Corn. Okay. Well, that one's on you.
The music is kind of like a hoedown.
Yes.
It just reminded me, too, that when I was in school, we had to learn some of that kind of dancing, you know, like square dancing.
Yeah, that was part of the curriculum
yeah,
somehow.
Like, why are we learning this? We live in Brooklyn. Like, what are you thinking?
I guess it was more appropriate for me growing up in Phoenix. I wonder if is square dancing still taught in some schools? I feel like when my kids were little, they were still teaching square dancing. There must be a lobby somewhere that is making sure that that's still taught in schools.
I like that idea, the square dancing lobby.
Yeah.
How were you first exposed to musicals? Like, where did you grow up? Did you see music theater? Was this all through movies?
I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. So I didn't see a lot of shows live, but my mom really loved musicals, and she had cast recordings for, I specifically remember Camelot, you know, loving as a pretty young kid and listening to it. I was a weird kid, you know, singing, I Wonder What the King Is Doing Tonight in my room, memorizing the lyrics. But I remember, you know, Camelot and South Pacific and Guys and Dolls. And that's where my love affair with musicals began. But also I remember seeing Singing in the Rain for the first time as a kid and Donald O'Connor doing Make Him Laugh. And I thought that was the greatest thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was so funny and I just loved it. So that's really where it began when I was a kid. And then I think a real key moment was I think I was 14 and was asked to play piano for my high school's musical. And it was How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And that really changed everything because then suddenly that became my tribe, you know, the theater kids, and they embraced me. And, you know, I desperately wanted to be on stage, but probably because I didn't really belong there. They kept saying, no, but Cinco, we need you on the piano. Please continue playing piano for us. But that's really where it deepened into something different. It became my community, you know?
Did you want to continue in the musical community? Because that's not the direction you went in until now.
You know, in college, I always sort of, you know, I wanted to be on stage. And so in college, I tried out for several musicals and didn't get in. And I did end up playing piano for a bunch of them. And so at some point I realized, well, maybe that's not my thing. And then I was really interested in being a pop musician. You know, I'd always written songs from a pretty early age. And so I think there was maybe a sense that, well, musical theater isn't cool and I want to be Elvis Costello, you know? And so that's what I focused. But people would continually tell me, oh, that sounds like something from a musical. And I was really offended. I'd say, like, what are you talking about? This is rock and roll, you know? And so I think life was telling me that that's where I belonged. And then, life is just weird. You make little choices and it pulls you in different directions. And I got pulled into screenwriting and then ended up writing all these animated movies. And I sort of set that part of me aside for a while.
Can you sing a few bars of one of your Elvis Costello-ish songs?
Oh my goodness. Let's see. Of man's last mistake and woman's first hurt, to the final heartache, from a fall to a flirt, I won't forgive and forget anymore. Oh my gosh. I haven't sung that song since I was like 19. That's a Cinco Paul classic called Forgive and Forget.
So you had a band?
Yeah, kind of, you know, I had a band in high school, but it was kind of like me just forcing them to accompany me for all my songs. So it wasn't a true band in the real sense. And then I just would do solo stuff, you know. I learned to play a bunch of instruments, and then I'd go into the recording studio and make albums. And really, that was kind of my dream. You know, I wanted to be Elvis Costello, Randy Newman, Paul McCartney, you know, all my heroes. And there was a point where I realized I got married and we were expecting our first child. And we were in North Carolina at the time. My wife was in med school. And the plan was always, after med school, we'll go to LA and I'll pursue my music career. But with impending fatherhood upon me, suddenly I started to really question, like, what is that going to be? And is that the life I want? So I got the idea to apply to film school. And I always felt very safe in academic settings. So I thought, I'll apply to film school. And if I get into USC or UCLA, that'll mean, you know, that maybe that's the direction my career should go. And I got into USC, and that kind of changed everything and got me on the screenwriting track as opposed to the pop musician track.
Now, we left something out of your music career, your early music career. You're a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, which most people, I think, know as the Mormon Church. Your mother was a part of the church. Your father was Catholic but not practicing. And you got baptized, I think, right after graduating from Yale.
No, right before I headed off to college.
Okay. And there was a musical celebrating the 150th anniversary of the church. And I think you wrote the songs for that?
I wrote everything. I wrote the book and the music and lyrics for that. It was about a modern girl and her great-great-great-grandmother, who was a pioneer girl who switched places.
Gosh, that's almost a little bit like Schmigadoon, where the modern and the past are colliding.
I know. I feel like maybe I've been writing the same thing over and over my whole career.
And so what was it a comedy or was it serious? Was it?
Yeah, it was comedy, which was, you know, sort of very different. Usually these productions are pretty serious, you know, and reverential. But, you know, it was only a couple performances, but it was really well received. And the biggest thing that happened in that was, that's where I met my writing partner, Ken Dario. He auditioned and was in the show. He, unlike me, is someone who belongs on stage. And we became friends. We formed a band. And then at some point I said, let's write a script together. And that changed everything.
Getting back to the musical that you did for the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, what was the reaction in the church to the musical?
Everybody really liked it. It got a bunch of laughs because I think people just weren't used to seeing one of these productions and have it be really a comedy at its heart. And so they actually, like 7 years later, they revived it. So I've had a revival of a musical. And they did it again 7 years later, but haven't done it since then. It's just sort of been languishing.
What are some of the movies and some of the cartoons that you grew up with?
The first cartoon I saw that really impacted me, I think, was The Jungle Book. I loved that movie so much, and the songs in that are so good. And then I have to say the Marx Brothers have played a huge role in my life. I'm sure that's why I ended up writing movies. I saw my first Marx Brothers movie when I was 10 on TV, and I fell in love with the Marx Brothers and became obsessed. And that really led to my love of movies and reading about movies and then starting to make my own with our family's Super 8 camera, which we'd gotten for home movies, you know, on vacation. And suddenly I used it just to make movies with all the neighborhood kids.
You love movies, and you and your writing partner, Ken Dario, have a podcast. Is this still going on, your podcast?
Yeah, it's called Make Him Watch It, and we make each other watch a movie we've never seen before.
Then you have a couple episodes where you share your opinions of films of the 80s and films of the 90s. But I want to play the theme song from this because I think it's you and Ken actually singing the song.
It is. I wrote the song.
Oh, you wrote the song. And so in the spirit of turning your life into a musical, I just want to play the opening theme from your podcast, Make Him Watch It.
Make him watch it. Make him watch it.
There's lots of movies Ken hasn't seen. Some Cinco hasn't seen too. So now that there's COVID-19,
here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna make him watch it for a podcast. We can't wait to make him watch it with Cinco and Ken.
I really love that. It's so like vaudeville era. Did you?
Yes.
How were you introduced to music of that period?
I mean, it probably came from my love of the Marx Brothers. You know, and you know, there a lot of their movies were kind of musicals. You know, The Coconuts, Animal Crackers, Horse Feathers has a lot of songs in it. So I think that led to my love of these 1920s songs, you know, the Tin Pan Alley stuff. And from the time, I was a weird little kid, Terry, I have to say. Like, to be a 10 or 11-year-old kid obsessed with that sort of music was very odd. But I loved it from an early age.
Well, listen, congratulations on Schmigadoon. Please do a season 2. And it's been great to talk with you.
From your mouth to God's ears. Terry, I have to say, it is so meaningful to me that you like the show and that you responded to it like this. Thank you so much.
Cinco Paul wrote all the songs for the satirical musical series Schmigadoon, which he also co-created and co-wrote. It's streaming on Apple TV+. The independent drama Coda was the runaway hit of this year's virtual Sundance Film Festival, where it won 4 awards in the American Dramatic Competition. Now it's playing in theaters and is streaming on Apple TV+. Coda tells the story of a teenage child of deaf parents, one of whom is played by Marlee Matlin, more than 3 decades after her Oscar win for Children of a Lesser God. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review of Coda.
The title of the new movie Coda is an acronym for Child of Deaf Adults. Here it refers to a teenager named Ruby, played by a terrific Amelia Jones, who's the only hearing member of her close-knit family. They run a scrappy fishing business in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and Ruby spends a lot of time helping out, joining the family on the water every morning before school, and serving as their interpreter. Ruby is also a talented singer and wants to attend music school in Boston. But she worries that her family might not be able to get by without her, and that they'll never understand her love for music. That's a pretty pat irony, but the writer-director Sean Hader seems well aware of it. Coda is an unabashedly formulaic coming-of-age story, but it uses that formula to show us characters and experiences we seldom see in movies. It's also proved unexpectedly divisive, rapturously received by many at Sundance for its sweet, heartfelt emotion, it's also been dismissed by others as bland and sentimental. It's been praised for putting a spotlight on deaf characters, but also criticized for putting a hearing character front and center. Not to be too equivocal about it, but I think there's an element of truth to all these arguments. Coda strikes me as both clumsy and lovely, and while I winced at its contrivances, I was also undeniably moved by it, in ways that caught me off guard. Much of that is due to the actors. Notably, the deaf characters are all played by deaf performers, thanks to the behind-the-scenes efforts of the movie's best-known actor, Marlee Matlin. She plays Ruby's mom, Jackie, while Troy Kotsur plays her dad, Frank. They're an endearingly rough-around-the-edges duo with a coarse sense of humor that the movie exaggerates for comic effect. Ruby is often embarrassed by their behavior, at home and in public. But it's partly their way of showing how unconcerned they are with what others, especially hearing people, think of them. Ruby's older brother, Leo, played by Daniel Durant, is just as defiant. He hates the ways he and his parents are marginalized for being deaf, and he often resents his younger sister for being their trusted go-between, Saint Ruby, as he calls her. Ruby's pretty tired of it herself, especially when life starts presenting other possibilities. She begins singing at school, and thrives under a teacher who encourages her to apply to Berklee College of Music. And this being a coming-of-age story, there of course has to be a romance, with a nice boy in her music class, whom Ruby pairs up with at one point for a duet of You're All I Need to Get By.
Like the sweet morning dew, I took one look at you, and it was plain to see you were my destiny. With my arms open wide, I threw away my pride. I'll sacrifice for you, dedicate my life to you. I will go where you lead, always there in time of need. And when I lose my will, you'll be there to push me off the hill. There's no looking back for us. We got love, sure enough, that's enough. You're all that I need, all that I need, all that I need to get by.
It might surprise some viewers to learn that Coda is an American remake of a 2014 French film called La Famille Bélier, since its richly textured portrait of a New England fishing community is one of the best things about it. The scenes of the family communicating at home are also a pleasure, even when the arguments get overheated. It's clear how close Ruby is to her parents and brother, but you also sense the gap that's opened up between them, aggravated by uncertainty about money and the family's future. The emotional dynamics between hearing and deaf family members are full of rich dramatic possibilities, and Coda, like any movie staking out new representational ground, shouldn't be expected to cover them all. Still, I couldn't help but wonder about some of its choices. The degree to which Ruby's family depends on her sometimes strains credulity. So does the suggestion that deaf people couldn't appreciate music or understand someone else's love for it. But if the tensions between Ruby and her family aren't always believable, there's great poignancy in the way Hader resolves those tensions. The final act of Coda is full of beats you'd expect, a touching concert, a suspenseful audition. But the one that sticks with you is a simple exchange in which Ruby and her father, played by Kotzer with a rough, curmudgeonly grace, come to a new understanding. It's a perfect tearjerker of a scene, wholly calculated and wholly effective. Coda may strike its share of false notes, but a note that sweet is really all it needs.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new film Coda. Coming up, Dr. Anna Lemke will talk about the interconnection of pleasure and pain and how that connection helps explain addiction. She's the medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University and author of the new book, Dopamine Nation. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about the interconnection of pleasure and pain and how that connection helps explain addiction. Not just addiction to alcohol and drugs like opioids, but addictions to food, sex, gambling, and social media. My guest, Dr. Anna Lemke, is the author of the new book, Dopamine Nation. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter, the chemical messenger, most involved in processing rewards. The more dopamine a drug or behavior releases, the more addictive it probably is. Dr. Lemke is a psychiatrist who's the medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University and chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. The clinic is for patients who have a mental health disorder like depression or bipolar syndrome, as well as a drug or alcohol addiction. She's also the author of the 2016 book, Drug Dealer MD, about how opioids were marketed to doctors to prescribe for their patients, which helped lead to the opioid epidemic. Dr. Anna Lemke, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with the basics. What is dopamine?
So dopamine is a neurotransmitter that sends signals from one neuron to another, and it's probably the most important neurotransmitter in our experience of pleasure, motivation, and reward.
So this is all stuff that's going on in the brain.
Yes, it's going on in the brain, exactly.
So what role does dopamine play in addiction?
Well, dopamine is the final common pathway for all pleasurable, intoxicating, rewarding experiences. So different drugs and behaviors work on different endogenous or innate systems. There's the opioid system, there's the cannabinoid system, there's the adrenaline system. But ultimately, the final common pathway of all of those rewarding substances and experiences is dopamine.
You write that the more dopamine any experience or substance releases, the more addictive it means that experience or substance is. So are scientists measuring dopamine release now to figure out what the most addictive drugs are or experiences?
So that experiment has been done in rats, for example, putting a probe in their brain, measuring the amount of dopamine released in response to different types of substances. Now, remember, we all have a baseline release of dopamine that's sort of always there. And then when we ingest certain substances or engage in certain behaviors, our dopamine either goes up or down in response to that substance or behavior. So, for example, chocolate increases dopamine above baseline about 50%. Sex is about 100%. Nicotine is about 150%. And amphetamines is about 1,000%.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And that explains why amphetamine is more addictive than chocolates or sex.
Well, yes and no. I mean, one of the reasons that amphetamine causes dopamine to be released at such a high level initially is because the actual mechanism of amphetamine is to directly release dopamine in the synapse. Whereas, for example, alcohol works through our endogenous opioid system, and so dopamine is more of a downstream result of alcohol ingestion. The other thing to keep in mind is that there's this whole concept of drug of choice, and what might be pleasurable and rewarding for you might not be pleasurable and rewarding for me. So in addition to the common pathways that all substances exert on our brain, we also have our inter-individual differences.
Let's talk about the interconnection of pleasure and pain. Pleasure and pain responses are located in overlapping parts of the brain. Can you describe the physiological overlap of pleasure and pain in the brain?
Sure. So to me, one of the most fascinating findings in neuroscience in the last 75 years is that the same areas of the brain that process pleasure also process pain, and that pleasure and pain work like a balance. So if you imagine that in your brain there's a teeter-totter, like something you would find in a kid's playground, and when that teeter-totter is at its resting baseline, it's level with the ground. When we do something that's pleasurable, for example, when I eat a piece of chocolate, then my pleasure-pain balance tilts just a little bit to the side of pleasure, and I experience a release of dopamine in my brain's reward pathway. But one of the governing principles regulating this balance is that it wants to remain level, which is what neuroscientists call homeostasis. It doesn't want to be deviated for very long, either to the side of pleasure or pain. So that when I eat a piece of chocolate, immediately what my brain will do is adapt to the presence of that pleasurable stimulus by tipping my balance an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. And that's the after effect or the come down, or in my case, that moment of wanting a second piece of chocolate. Now, if I wait long enough, that feeling passes and homeostasis is restored.
So describe the pain after the pleasure. Is it like I'm disappointed that this experience of eating the chocolate is now over? Or is it more like craving, I want more of it, I want more of that pleasure, and not having that pleasure, it's increasing my sense of pain.
Yeah, great question. So it's really both, right? So when that pleasure-pain balance tilts to the side of pain after the experience of pleasure, that pain is subjectively experienced as a number of different things. One of it is just like a subjective feeling of being uncomfortable, restless, irritable, unhappy, and wanting to recreate the feeling of pleasure. But that's also in many ways what craving is, right? So not wanting to have the pleasure again, being preoccupied with eliminating the experience of pain that we feel in the aftermath. And I will say too, it's very reflexive. It's not like I'm even consciously aware of that after effect or the come down. It can be very subtle, but I'm just sort of aware of wanting to have another piece of chocolate.
With repeated exposure to the same pleasure or a similar pleasure, whether it's an experience or if it's chocolate or if it's a drug, you keep wanting more of it. So why? What's going on? Why do you keep wanting more? Why does it take more and more to keep you satisfied?
So the way that I think about it or visualize it in my brain is that after I have a pleasurable experience, like I have a piece of chocolate, then these little gremlins hop on the pain side of my balance to bring the balance level again. But the gremlins really like it on the balance, so they don't get off. Again, they stay on until my balance is tipped an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. And again, that's the after effect or the hangover or the come down. Now, with waiting, the gremlins hop off and balance is restored, but the gremlins never entirely go away. They're sort of left in our brain. They're the neuroadaptation gremlins, which means that if I do eat a second piece of chocolate, my gremlins are ready to go, right? I don't need to create them. They hop right on the balance. And in fact, they tip that balance harder and longer to the side of pain. So what that means is that with repeated exposure to any pleasurable experience, the initial stimulus of pleasure gets weaker and shorter, and the after effect of pain gets stronger and longer, which means that over time, I need more and more of the initial stimulus to get the same effect. And this is what's called tolerance, needing more of the drug to get the same effect, or finding that over time, the same dose of the drug has less of an impact.
So you keep needing more and more, and that explains why people can get addicted to food and can sometimes overeat. It explains, I guess, sex addiction. And certainly, does that explain drug addiction too? Is there more going on in drug addiction than there is to, say, eating chocolate? Because certain drugs also have, I think, more physiological addictive qualities, more chemical, I should say, addictive qualities.
You know, this phenomenon really pertains to all rewarding experiences. And what happens over time, and which is essentially the fundamental process that leads to addiction, is that if I continue to consume a dopamine-releasing high-reward drug or behavior, that after a while, in order to try to reassert homeostasis, I develop so many gremlins on the pain side of my balance that they fill the entire room, which means that when I'm not using my drug, I'm essentially miserable, right? I'm in a dopamine deficit state. I have a pleasure-pain balance that's tilted to the side of pain. And now I need to use my drug not to feel good, but just to restore a level balance, just to feel normal. And when I'm not using my drug, I experience the universal symptoms of withdrawal, irritability, anxiety, insomnia, dysphoria, and mental preoccupation with using my drug, which we call craving. So the important message here is that when people become addicted, when we become addicted, we essentially change our brains and reset our threshold for experiencing pleasure and pain such that it's harder to experience pleasure and easier to experience pain because we have a pleasure-pain balance tilted to the side of pain.
So that's the central paradox of your book, is that the pursuit of pleasure can actually lead to pain.
That's exactly right, that hedonism ultimately leads to anhedonia, or lack of joy.
People very loosely say, oh, I'm addicted to my cell phone, or I'm addicted to social media. And they don't literally mean they're addicted to it, but do you think people literally do get addicted to cell phones and social media?
I do think that people literally get addicted to cell phones and social media, yes. It's important to recognize that addiction is a spectrum disorder, and it is possible to be a little bit addicted. Also, the same brain mechanisms that mediate severe addiction also mediate our minor addictions. So we're all evolutionarily designed to approach pleasure and avoid pain. And that kind of neurobiological wiring is exactly what has kept us alive for millennia. And it's also the very same wiring that makes us all vulnerable to addiction. So I don't think that anybody is immune from this problem. And I do believe that smartphones are addictive. They've been engineered to be addictive. And that it doesn't really, we don't really need more studies to show that that's true. All you need to do is go outside and look around.
Dr. Lemke, you write that the brain was not designed to live in a world of overabundance. And in some countries, like the U.S., in some socioeconomic classes, people do have overabundance in their lives, easy access to foods, to many varieties of foods, to many things to read, movies to watch, drugs to take, experiences to have. Why isn't our brain adapted to that? Why is this overabundance a problem that can lead to pain and addiction?
The mechanisms in our brain that compel us to approach pleasure and avoid pain were evolved over millions of years for a world of scarcity. And in a world of scarcity, in order for us to stay alive, we have to be extremely motivated to go out and seek food, clothing, and shelter. The problem is, in today's modern ecosystem, those things are all provided. We don't even have to get up off the couch in order to have them come to us. And our brains were really not wired for that. And as a result, I think living in this modern age is very challenging, but for different reasons. We're now having to cope with, how do I live in a world in which everything is provided, and if I consume too much of it, which my reflexes compel me to do, I'm going to be even more unhappy. That's really what Dopamine Nation is about, trying to figure out how to live in that world and holding up people in recovery from addiction as modern day prophets for how to do that.
Let's talk about some practical suggestions you give your patients about how to end behavioral or chemical addiction. One of the things you emphasize is radical honesty. What do you mean by that?
Over the years, seeing many wonderful patients in recovery, one of the recurring themes that has stood out to me is how telling the truth, not just about big important things in their lives, but about everything, is central to their recovery from addiction. And I got really curious about that. I started to wonder, gee, what is that? Why is it that telling the truth would be so important to stopping these addictive behaviors? And my research led to a lot of fascinating different discoveries about the role of truth-telling in our lives, not just as a way to limit compulsive overconsumption and addiction, but also just to have better lives, to improve the quality of our relationships with others, with ourselves. And so one of the things I recommend to my patients, in addition to, the initial period of the dopamine fast or the abstinence, is I say to them, in this month, I want you to try really hard not to lie about anything. And by that, I mean not just don't lie about your substance use or your online behaviors or whatever it is. I want you to try really hard not to lie about anything, why you were late to work, you know, why you had a second piece of cake or whatever it was. And I warn them that it's really hard because on average, you know, the average adult tells about 1 to 2 lies a day. We all lie, you know, we lie in ways large and small, and it's really hard to tell the truth. And to tell the truth, you actually have to have like an active sort of truthometer going on where you're sort of constantly observing what you're saying and saying to yourself, now, am I telling the truth? Was that really the whole truth and nothing but the truth? But I think it has really important brain health properties. And the most important among them is probably that it strengthens the ties between our prefrontal cortex and our limbic brain. So the prefrontal cortex is that part of our brain just behind our forehead, engaged in decision making, long range planning, a delayed gratification, storytelling. So telling the truth strengthens that part of the brain, and in turn strengthens the connections between that part of our brain and our reward pathway, which is a much older, more primitive part of our brain. And it thereby helps us really control our reward pathway and control our consumption.
Dr. Lemke, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I'm such a big fan of your show, and it's really an honor to be on.
Dr. Anna Lemke is the author of the new book, Dopamine Nation. She's the medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.